Here for the Lowe's early Black Friday deals? You're right on time for some of our biggest savings. We're talking up to 50% off select major appliances, plus up to an extra 25% off when you bundle select major appliances. Holiday lights going up soon? Select ladders are up to 50% off right now. Get Black Friday prices without the Black Friday crowds. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 11/19. Selection varies by location. Select locations only. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Good evening and welcome to this evening's episode of the Mary Trump Show with, I'm so happy I get to say this, with my guest, Dahlia Lithwick, who is the senior legal analyst for Slate, also proprietor of the excellent podcast Amicus, and author, most recently, just came out this Tuesday, of Lady Justice. And for my purposes, I am very grateful to be able to say my friend, and for our purposes, fellow nerd adventurer, Dahlia, it is so good to have you here, especially since it's such a quiet news week and we can just focus on your book.
Yeah, good thing nothing's happening. That's good.
Yeah. So I guess you've just been kicking back and taking advantage of how quiet everything
spray
is.
Spray tan. I had a spray tan. Took 6 hours.
Well, first of all, congratulations on the book. It is, it's an excellent, necessary book. That, I mean, this doesn't come as a surprise to anybody because it's you, but it's phenomenally well written. And I think it is an amazing compendium of narratives that locate us very clearly in confusing times. And even though much of the narrative arc of the story takes place from 2017 on, it definitely grounds us in the history of how we got here. And one of the things I most love about the book is the way you, and I assume this just kind of happened naturally because of the stories you focus on and the protagonist of each story, we get this incredible insight into how power works both within and outside of institutions, and how both of those things can work concurrently, can work against each other, how both are important in their own ways. So how did you get the idea for the book, and how did you decide to focus on the particular narratives was it narrative driven, or was it protagonist driven, if you know what I'm saying?
Can I, just before I answer you, I just want to say, when my older son went to sleepaway camp for the first time, and I had my younger son who was probably like, I don't know, 7 or 8. Mm-hmm. And I realized like he was a whole fully realized person who like lived in the shadow of his big brother. I'm so excited to be one-on-one with you and not have to like, you know, kind of like scrabble for attention and be like, no, Wash, I'm talking. So I just want to say, for folks who don't understand the incredibly complicated sibling relationships that exist and the competitive propensity to like seek attention on the Nerd Avenger family, I just want to say, like, I completely feel like I'm basking in the glow of your time. And I just say that not to suck up, but just because none of them are here to defend themselves. Okay. So now I want to answer your incredibly serious question with some sobriety and seriousness. I think, Mary, that
right, by the way, I just want to make it clear. You've totally staked out your claim on the Nerd Adventures. So I wouldn't worry, but I'm so psyched to have you all to myself. So,
okay.
There you go.
Okay. Question seriously to be answered starting now. I think look, this book evolved a lot. When I started writing it, it was really the depths of 2017. I think like a lot of people, it felt as though the sky was falling in, that it could not get any worse, imagine. And these were, a lot of these were just stories that I had covered, right? I had covered Becca Heller and the Muslim ban. I had covered, you know, the Bridget Amiri's chapter on, you know, the ways in which immigrant and migrant teens and asylum seekers at the border were unable to get abortion care that they were legally entitled to have. So I'd covered right. these cases and I knew these characters, yeah. but I certainly had a list of, you know, 20, 30 people that I would have happily talked about. But I think two things happened. One is I was so worried, and I know I say this a lot when we talk, about the crumbling confidence in institutions, that one of the things I really wanted this to be was sort of making the claim that institutions are not broken. They're just being abused.
Right.
And that if you say there's no point in my voting because my vote doesn't matter, or if you say, you know, there's no point in my engaging with the media because everybody in the media is lying, or if you say any of the things that the nihilists want you to say, then Steve Bannon wins, right? Because
yes.
the whole project is to completely foment mistrust of all institutions. And I'm, you know, I frequently say, Mary, I'm the most small C conservative radical you'll ever meet, because I actually believe in an independent Justice Department. I believe yep. in an independent Article III judiciary. And so some of this was conceived as a kind of cri de coeur to say the law isn't what's broken. Lawlessness is broken, and that the law can be used to affect huge, huge change and progress. And I think one of the things I really wanted to point out, this is around the time that we noticed that Donald was losing all the freaking lawsuits, right? I mean, he had yep. the losingest record of any president in history. Just presumptively, presidents win most of the time, and he kept losing. And he lost because he was lawless. And yep. even Trump judges and even Bush judges and Reagan judges acknowledge that. And so I think a big thing I wanted to do was, A, you know, as you say, tell stories, because I think these are amazing stories. These are incredible characters. I want people to see themselves in these different lawyers and say, oh, you know, maybe I'm a big firm lawyer, but I could do this like Robbie Kaplan. Maybe I'm, you know, an organizer like Vanita Gupta. I can do this. So there was that. There was the stories and the characters. But I really think the arc of this thing is a kind of at least an opening argument for the power of the law in the hands of good people to do good things.
Definitely. And we see that in the subjects you picked. I mean, these are dedicated people coming at issues from very different places and perspectives, but with the same goal in mind. Which is, and I believe it was Vanita Gupta who said this, and I kind of see her as a central character, or her narrative as central, or as maybe the center of the book, because as you describe her, she's an inside outsider. She's played both sides. You know, she gets the job at the Justice Department, having done nothing in her career except sue the government, you know, and that's a really fascinating transition. And then she goes back when she joins, becomes head of the leadership conference. So that was really cool. But you know, they're all coming at this with the understanding that just sort of siloing your goal allows the systems to remain, again, not broken, because they're not, but inadequate to the purpose of shoring up democracy, right? If you're only focusing on one thing, then you're losing sight of the bigger picture. And these women all understood that.
Here's what I would right. say to that. I think Vanita Gupta becomes kind of a weird breakout star of this book. And in some yeah. sense, you know, it's a complicated chapter because she's an organizer. She's somebody who has litigated all her life, and then ends up at the leadership conference not litigating, but in fact organizing other litigants and organizing groups. And I think you're exactly right. For me, it's a pivot point at the center of the book, because it's where the book goes from a bunch of lawsuits that are sort of like the thrills, the chills, the spills, into, oh, this is the work. And the work yeah. isn't, you know, Law and Order, and there's no like dun-dun, you know, like nothing happens. She's just trying to build coalitions and build power. And so in a sense, I thought this was a chapter that people would kind of glide over, but it is a chapter that's about really deep work. And as you said, about a character who just could not believe when Eric Holder said to her, "Do you want to come work for me?" after she had done nothing but make trouble. Right. And the tension that she's experiencing is not just like that institutional tension you're describing, right? Where she's like, wait, but the Justice Department, like that's the place that, you know, so much lawlessness comes from. But also I think the tension that she feels around the law itself. And she's one of the people who really candidly says, and I pressed almost every subject of the book on this question of the law really sucks for women. And if you're Vanita Gupta, for women of color, if you are Nina Perales, who in the chapter on gerrymandering, you know, a woman who does, you know, literally racial gerrymandering as her job. And I think that they raise this really intractable question that I'm struggling with. I know you think about it all the time, which is we are clinging to the law, right? And to legal systems, to the Justice Department. And yet in the worst possible way, it is in fact the object of our oppression. It is the thing that is hurting us. It was, you know, we talk about this all the time. At the founding, women were invisible and they were chattel, and you could be raped by your husband and, you know, apparently burned as a witch. And, you know, all of this stuff we had to invent. We had to claw our way through this system that really disempowered us deliberately. And so Vanita is one of the people who gives voice to this notion that, like, yes, the legal system is racist. And yes, the legal system is punitive and the carceral system is broken and it's all just terrible. And it's the best thing we have. And so I love that she's not just an insider outsider on this narrow question you're asking about what do you do with institutions and how do you sort of fix institutions that are fundamentally really slow to change. But this huge question that all of these women have, you know, Becca Heller in her chapter about the Muslim ban is like, look, master's tools, master's house. It's that simple. Yep. The law sucks, but I'm going to use it to get, you know, my clients relief. And other people like Anita Hill are so lofty about the grandeur of, right? She's like, but we got Brown v. Board, right? We got Obergefell. And so I think threaded through this, that anxiety that you're sort of laying out about how much you can rely on a legal system that was always warped against women's interests to redeem women's equality and dignity.
And that's one of the fascinating tensions. You talk about people like Anita Hill. You talk about people like Sally Yates, small C conservative institutionalist people, both of whom, by the way, have not been well served by their respective institutions necessarily. But, you know, who believe fundamentally in the power of institutions. And then people like Becca Heller and somebody else I really like you to talk about, Pauli Murray. Whom you start the book speaking about, because I think that was a fascinating jumping off point for the broader conversation. And most people, I'd never heard of her either, which is, you know, another issue. But, you know, at the very beginning of the book, you say even a woman with grievous doubts about the American legal system can leverage that system to benefit everyone. And that kind of becomes the raison d'etre, in some ways, of all of these various missions that these women are on.
I mean, you've hit on this is my pain point, Mary, and it is, there's no doubt that I could have written just, you know, more about RBG, right? Like, all of us have this, like, desperate need for heroes, and I would submit, like, it's a good thing, right, that our legal hero is this, like, 40-pound octogenarian who, you know, pretty much single-handedly invented gender equality in the 1970s, except she didn't, right? And she gets too much credit. Not that she doesn't deserve the credit for what she did, but she leaned heavily on the work of many other people. And I will say, to be fair, she was absolutely meticulous about crediting the people that came before. In the brief that she submitted in Doe v. Reed, which becomes, you know, one of the most important gender equality cases, she name checks Pauli Murray. She writes Pauli Murray's name on the brief as though Pauli Murray would co-counsel, because she's so careful to say, these are not all my ideas. But just to be brief, Pauli Murray is this unbelievable character. I would say one of the kind of prime movers of using the 14th Amendment, not just for gender equality, but for racial equality. And Pauli Murray is long before there's a word for being trans, long before there is a word for being non-binary. Right. Pauli Murray feels that she is a boy who is trapped in a woman's body and spends, I would say there, because I think at today Pauli Murray would want to be called their life, struggling with that, is Black and therefore turned away from universities that absolutely should have admitted her, is a woman and therefore turned away from law schools that should have admitted, you know, encounters time after time after time, barriers. And nevertheless, the brief that she ends up writing in law school, unbeknownst to her, becomes the spine of Brown v. Board. Right. Nobody tells her that Brown v. Board is based on a paper she wrote in law school. She finds out long after. And Pauli Murray is this incredible figure who, you know, refuses to move to the back of the bus before Rosa Parks, and who is desegregating lunch counters before lunch counter desegregation is a thing. Every move she makes is prophetic, and every legal idea she has shaped the world we live in now, and nobody's heard of her. So I started with her partly to kind of make that leap away from the hagiography around RBG and to say there are armies of women, many of them Black and brown, who've been doing this work for decades uncredited. And I want to really probe this question of who gets famous and why, because too many people that are famous, as you know, better than anyone, are famous.
At least as well as.
Yeah, I mean, get famous for doing what others have done before. But maybe, and this is the last wrinkle in this, I really want to do away with this idea that if you kind of have your Advent candle and it has Bob Mueller is going to save us on it, and then the next month it says, you know, Adam Schiff is going to save us, and the next month it says, you know, whoever the hero du jour is, and that's how we go. We ping from hero to hero, and we buy the mugs, and we, you know, like the memes, but like, that's not democracy, right? That right. is a branding exercise. And this is no insult to, you know, Mueller or Schiff, but it's to say, I love the idea of a democracy in which everybody is working as hard as Pauli Murray, even if they don't get credit.
And you point out later in the book that, you know, a lot of people do give credit. Ketanji Brown Jackson, you know, these are women who are well aware, Stacey Abrams, well aware of who came before. And it just makes me wonder, though, like, why don't the rest of us Why do the rest of us forget that?
I mean, in the introduction, I quote from an amazing essay that was written just around the time that I started the book by Rebecca Solnit, the political philosopher, you know, where she says the hero is the problem. And she says this is just endemic, that Americans are just too in love with the John Wayne, you know, white hat guy who's going to save us all.
Yeah, and baseball players get to be heroes in America.
Right. And that, you know, it's just a sort of cultural norm that lets us bear witness to heroism without participating in it. And I think that's part of it. I also think, I mean, and we're seeing it right now, right? I mean, we are absolutely seeing it with the January 6th investigation. Like, we need to see upstanding, moral, ethical people performing virtue, because we almost forget what it looks like. And so I think it's essential in a lot of ways, but I think that it's not this binary thing where, because Adam Schiff is moving through the world, or Jamie Raskin or Lynn Cheney is moving through the world, stipulated that's more complicated, but that we all can just sit back and pop popcorn. That like pop popcorn meme, you know, they're like, oh, I'm just, used to make me crazy, because this is not a spectator sport. And so I think that, again, one of the reasons I fell in love with the sort of protagonists of this book is that some of them just slog away. Robbie Kaplan filed the lawsuit against the white supremacists and Nazis in Charlottesville in 2017. That case didn't go to trial until 2021. It was just years of slogging, uncredited discovery, taking depositions with people who had their like minions threatening, you know, death threats against herself and Karen Dunn. And they just did the work. And I love that because I just don't think that anyone makes movies about people who are doing the work.
And that's a really good reminder for those of us who've been impatient. And we have every right to be. Especially when it comes to somebody like Donald, because like how many decades do we need to wait for one person to be held accountable for something? However, justice time runs differently. And it's not like people are just sitting around twiddling their thumbs. You know, there people like Robbie Kaplan are putting in the hard yards for days, weeks, months, years on end without not only without recognition, but without anybody knowing they're doing it. So I think that was a helpful perspective for me because I do get really impatient, honestly. But it takes that kind of dogged determination to be unrelenting in the face of very little positive reinforcement, to say the least.
Yeah, and a lot of it is secret. Like one of the things yep. that you and I know now in the rearview mirror is the work that went into those, you know, Mar-a-Lago searches and how yep. unbelievably scrupulously the Justice Department did their work so that it would be bulletproof. Now, let's see what the 11th Circuit says. Let's see what the Supreme Court says. But we're never going to know some of the work that went into that, and we will never know the names of some of the players. But again, I think for me, this metaphor of how law is done is really, really a lot more interesting than falling in love with whoever the lawyer du jour is, right. Who's a talking head. Because I think that, again, many talking heads are great lawyers, but I just think this is not a thing that happens quickly, and it is not a thing that happens necessarily with fanfare.
Exactly. And, you know, the subtitle of your book is Women, the Law, and the Battle to Save America. All of the people featured are women, but you know the point is that they're brilliant, they're skilled, they're professionals, they're at the top of their game. However, it does matter. I mean, we see you know, so something that really jumped out at me, and it was I think it was in the Vinita Gupta section. But this idea that vulnerability is a gateway to organizing. And I think that's a perspective that is less comfortable for men, first of all. And secondly, and I think this is a direct quote from Vinita Gupta, you know, what litigators have failed to do is build power and the public will for the country we want to be. And I'm not entirely sure why, but those things seem related to me. You know, it's not an accident that the people at the forefront of a lot of these cases that require, in some ways, kind of using the institutions against themselves almost, right? Being savvy and knowledgeable enough about where there's room to push, right, against the systems that have bound us all in ways that are not good, that are not fair, that are not small d democratic, to reshape, reconstitute, redeploy resources in a way that men might not, because they're blinded to the ways in which they inherently benefit from systems as they exist and have always existed in this country.
Yeah, it's
was that convoluted enough?
No. I mean, I think you've scraped on one of the things that, and the New York Times book review that came out on Tuesday really pulled on this thread of.
Interesting. I didn't read it. Okay, I'm going to have to read it now.
I mean, it pulled very, very much on this, you know, there's a whole section in the middle about Me Too and complicity mm-hmm. and why women don't speak up, why they sit in kind of subordinate positions and don't fight even when there's egregious abuse happening. And I think makes the point, exactly the point you're making, that these systems are kind of already constructed to kind of push women down. And then women have to really grapple with, how long do I stick this out before I just, it is a system of my oppression. And, you know, Anita Hill talks about this in the book. Liv Warren, who was another young woman who Me Too'd a federal judge, you know, she talks about sort of like howling into the void of, what do you do when you've given yourself to this system that does not respect you or you know, hold you in any primacy? And listen, Mary, you know, you and I have been having conversations since Dobbs came down about the massive disparity between the men, some of whom were good, you know, progressive allies, who kept saying, you're hysterical about SB 8, the Texas vigilante bill, mm-hmm. calm down. You know, the day SB 8 went into effect, I had on my podcast, Michelle Goodwin and Rebecca Traister, and all three of us were saying, this is the worst thing in the world. The court just nullified Roe. They did it for a tenth of the population, and yep. they're doing it on the shadow docket. And the mail we got was just like, oh, I listen to your show because it's about the law, not listening to hysterical females crying and wringing their hands. And I thought, wow, so interesting, exactly what you're saying, that if it doesn't affect you, it's really easy to say, well, you know, maybe if they overturn Roe, it'll be really good for the midterms, as though that is somehow, you know, negates the cost of women who are being left to bleed out, right, from a miscarriage. And so I think one of the things that you're identifying is so many of the women in this book, including Vanita, including Anita Hill, talk about, you know, here's a set system that kind of stepped over Anita Hill and said, oh, well, thanks for your service, but, you know, he's going on the court. Stepped over Christine Blasey Ford, said, oh, by the way, we all believe you. We think yeah. he was lying, but there's nothing to be done. And now he's invited to all the parties, and he's, you know, one of nine co-equal justices who just overturned Roe. And I think that a lot of women are really frustrated and mad. And women of color times 11, because they never had the awakening that a lot of us had in June when we were like, wait, they overturned Roe. So I guess that what you are sketching out here is one of the things that I've really been struggling with, which is, at what point do you just walk away and say the system fundamentally does not respect or care for women or people of color, LGBTQ people, immigrants? It just doesn't. It's built to support exactly the norms and privileges of the founders. And at what point do you just say, like you said, okay, I cabin off my little corner and I chip away at my little thing. And, you know, sometimes you get a Brown v. board, and sometimes you get an Obergefell. Yeah, and sometimes you get Dobbs.
It was actually quite painful to revisit the Anita Hill and Christine Blasey Ford incidents. Because for that very reason, you know, I think those are the challenges of being pushed to that point where you think, is there any reason to continue to try to work within this? Can we ever use the systems and the institutions to again, not repair them because they're not broken, but to reimagine them. I like to think of it in those terms. Like, I don't think you can tear anything down. I don't think we can start from scratch, although God knows I'd love to be able to. But I think we can reimagine things, because not everything is worth throwing out, right? But then there are those moments when, and we talked about this before the show started, when even people who are our allies, like legitimately our allies, don't understand the fight, don't understand the threat to people who are not inherently protected by the system, and don't understand what their role is. And we certainly saw that. We were speaking most recently of the Ketanji Brown Jackson hearings. But obviously that conversation was motivated by the revisiting of what Anita Hill went through and what Christine Blasey Ford went through, which was unspeakable. And it's this idea, and I think this may be like one of the biggest problems of our time, that, well, you know, once the white guy gets in, there's just nothing you can do about it. You know, he's going to be Supreme Court Justice for life. Yeah, he was in the Oval Office, so it kind of, it would just be unseemly to indict him or arrest him, right? So it's sort of, it just begs the question, who exactly are we protecting here? And what will it take to find a way in which the so-called massive faceless institutions bring about justice instead of perpetuating the opposite?
So Sherrilyn Ifill, who's one of my heroes, yeah, who was the head of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, was on my show, and I asked her a version of this question, and she reminded me, and she's just very much like Pauli Murray, a poet. I mean, I don't think she knows how what she says sort of lodges in your imagination. But she said that we focus too much on January 6th and forget what happened on January 5th. And January 5th, if life had proceeded without an insurrection, saw two Senate seats in Georgia, entirely engineered by the work of Stacey Abrams and the army of people that she has inspired and helped to believe in the sort of aspirational project of democracy that you're describing, right? Not fixing, but reimagining democracy, and somehow elect like a Jew and a black man, and we get control of the Senate. All that happens on January 5th. That's unthinkable. That is unthinkable, considering especially the vote suppression that went on in Georgia.
Yes.
And I think her point is, we get blinkered, right? We get so focused on January 6th that we don't see the utter miracle and the human-driven, organizing good miracle of January 5th. And I think the larger point is, it sucks right now, stipulated. It sucks. And it sucks. And it's
speaking
sucks
of poetry.
I mean, it sucks right now. If I say it in a sort of lilting voice.
No, it sucks.
It sucks. But I think that we forget that this stuff happens in ebbs and flows, that it will always be sort of two steps forward, one step back. That is sort of the nature of progress, particularly when you have authoritarians and fascists who are warping systems. And I think it's really useful to remember that January 5th was kind of a quasi-miracle done within the four corners of constitutional democracy, and we will have those again. It doesn't mean that there aren't very serious impediments, but what it does mean is that we can't blind ourselves to the ways in which the system holds. And the system held in no small part, in my view, because of some of these women doing this thankless work in the book. But I think the system holds also because we continue to believe that it's better to have a system than to have chaos. Chaos, you know, street fighting, like, you know who gets nailed first, Mary? You and me. You know, it's not good. And so I think we have to just say that, and you're quite right, and we've talked about this too, so much that we thought was codified law are soft norms. Those norms need to be bolstered. They need to be enshrined in law. Yep. But that requires people believing in them. That requires people saying, my vote, although statistically insignificant, matters, and I am going to vote. And even if, you know, everyone is telling me that the system is rigged and the fix is in, that I'm going to do it anyway. And so I think maybe just to go back to what you sort of led with, one of the things that I really come down in this book is that one of the special magical powers that I think some of these women have is imagination, moral mm-hmm. imagination.
Yep.
And I think moral imagination, it's not that it's uniquely the province of women or women lawyers, but I do think it is something that, and this is when Sherrilyn Ifill talks about empathy, which is, I think, a component of moral imagination mm-hmm. that comes easier to women because this has been so hard fought.
Right. And vulnerability is also a necessary component of that as well. And I think in to Sherrilyn Ifill's point and yours, in forgetting January 5th, and I get why people do, you know, it's been kind of crazy since then. But we, on the one hand, fail to recognize the extraordinary work of people like Stacey Abrams and Latosha Brown and many others in accomplishing that goal. We fail to recognize the extent to which voter suppression is a massive problem in this country that's getting worse along with voter subversion. We forget that Stacey Abrams did this in the wake of having, in my view, won the gubernatorial election, but, you know, shrugged it off, probably maybe wrote a romance novel in between, but then got right back to work, even became president of United Earth. Come on, the woman is a multitasker. So we forget that too. And I think that that kind of failure to keep those hard-won victories in front of mind leads us to a situation in which Senator Warnock might lose to one of the worst candidates for Senate in the history of this country. You know, it's a sort of a massive failure of respect to forget about January 5th and not understand what forgetting that entails.
So, Mary, whenever I'm on your show, the part where I can just see in my mind's eye all the listeners get up and, like, go to the bathroom and, like, you know, pour themselves, like, a beer and come back is when I start talking about, like, systems failure, right? And when I start saying, you know, this is a malapportioned Senate. This is the Electoral College, right? 41 million people are, like, erased by the current structure of the Senate. I mean, we can talk all day about dark money. Thanks, Supreme Court. And gerrymandering. Thanks, Supreme Court. And racial gerrymandering. Thanks again, Supreme. Like, we can talk all day about the complete circle of abuse of power that has allowed, like, five of the six justices on the conservative supermajority to be appointed by presidents who lost the popular vote. And then,
I had to go get a beer. Why don't you give the front desk a call?
That doesn't, like, represent half the population. Like, we can talk all day about how, and then what do they do? Oh, they restrict voting. Amazing, right? I mean, Samuel Alito writing in the Dobbs decision, you know, women, if you don't like this, just go out and vote. As the court is, like, taking away the right to vote, is just like, beer out your nose funny if you all are just coming back from having poured yourself a beer. And, like, it's ridiculous that this system is as completely warped and distorted as it is. So you are not going to get me to, like, defend the status quo because it's insane. But you are going to get me to say that there are good people working right now on fixing the Electoral Count Act and on, you know, doing away with the Electoral College, and good people who are working on fixing, you know, a malapportioned Senate and serious structural Supreme Court reform. This is not stuff we have to imagine or invent. It's there, but we need to buy into it. Yeah. And I guess what I'm positing for you is, in the binary of, you know, everything about the legal system and the constitutional system sucks and it's all perfect and magic, and, you know, Donald is magic and can't be prosecuted because he's God, there is all this complexity of work, of structures and systems work, that requires a buy-in from every one of us. And in the end of the day, the reason I kind of wrote a little pink book about all those structures and systems, and the last three chapters are about voting, is because I really think we can do this, but saying it all sucks gets us nowhere.
Right. Although it does suck. But not all of it. No, but not all of it. And one of the things that I really love about this book is because the stories, each story is a standalone, discrete narrative, right? You don't need any of the other stories to understand each one as it unfolds. However, there is this overarching sense that each one of these women, each one of the fights they're fighting is a different facet of the problem we face. And that, again, is a problem that the systems are working as they're intended by the founders and other powerful white men. And that democracy, America has never been a democracy and needs to be, but that each of them in their own way brings to the fight a different weapon. So it isn't just about litigating. It can't be. It isn't just about organizing. It can't be. It isn't just about the issue. It can't be. It's all of those things. It's, as you say, moral imagination. It's lobbying. It's education. It's voting and organizing and litigation. And in understanding it that way, I think it does give everybody a sense of purpose and a sense of where they can find their power.
It's always so fun to talk to you because you're such a careful reader. And that was absolutely, for me, that was the mandate, was that everybody could find something in here to say, you know, I didn't really understand about, you know, redistricting reform, but I kind of do now. Or, you know, I didn't really fully understand, you know, the nature of, you know, the line between protected free speech under the First Amendment and incitement to violence in Charlottesville, and to find a path to just think about what my part, what my buy-in could be here. And you don't have to be a lawyer to do this. I mean, this book is not for lawyers, but I think you have to believe, as you're saying, in the project. And I've said this so many times on your show, you know, if we had a plan B that was better than the one that I'm putting forth, you know, if we could just like figure skate our way to a better democracy, I would be for that. Cause like, it's not great, but we don't. And I, what worries me.
Can I play tennis on our way to play tennis? Cause I figure skating nuts so much, but I see your point.
I'm thinking of those like fast backward skaters, but yeah, you can play tennis. But I think, I think, you know, this is what we have. And maybe I'll say this because I think it's important. I think that, listen, I went to law school as 50-50 women, right?
Yep.
When the book starts with three women on the Supreme Court, like tearing down the Solicitor General of Texas, who's trying to ding Roe v. Wade and Casey. We were really close in 2016, much closer than we are now. Right. And I think it's just easy to fall asleep and to say, oh, we're equal. We got equality. You know, we can have credit cards now, and we no longer have to, you know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg had to hide her pregnancy when she was a law professor because she would have been fired, right? So we like to be really sanguine about how equal and fair and just everything is. And one of the things the last 6 years has taught us, like often with a punch in the neck, is it is not fair, it's not equal, and it's not just. Oh, and coda to that, if you were a person of color, if you were poor, if you were elderly in this country, if you were an immigrant, it never was. Right. And so I think maybe the benefit of this awakening, if you can call it that, to the flaws in the system is that we can all see it now. We can all see. Mm-hmm. And there is some utility in the painful realization that we had so much magical thinking about equality and dignity and, you know, the protection of the law and the force of law. We were just sleepwalking our way through this thing. And right. It sucks to have to wake up from that. But at least now it's very clear to me where the fault lines are and where the fights are.
Yeah. And the fact that the book is bookended by two Supreme Court decisions, both of which involve three female justices, the most recent basically relegated women to second class citizenship. It's a gut punch. It again, nobody should be surprised that it happened. It's still a gut punch. And this isn't to demoralize anybody. This is something you and I say often. We need to have our eyes wide open. And by understanding what can happen in a very short period of time. Yeah, okay, women got the right to credit cards in, what, the 70s? And now they don't have a right of to control what they do with their own bodies. So it is a painful but necessary reminder that none of this is nothing is an end point. Nothing ends. It's all a process. And we need to take a page out of the rights playbook and understand that and never say, oh, well, hey, you know, we got this right and everything's cool now and we're just going to go chill and not have to worry about it again. Because clearly that's absurd on its face. It's one of the prices you pay. If you want to be a citizen in a democracy, you have to vote. You have to pay attention. You have to be connected. And, you know, if we've learned nothing else, that it's, yeah, the Supreme Court can draw out, not draw out, what am I trying to say? The Supreme Court can grant rights. They don't guarantee them. That's up to us.
That's exactly right. And I think, you know, for me, again, you know, I was so struck this whole year by how much I didn't know, not about, you know, you sort of copped to not having heard about Pauli Murray, and people should definitely watch the movie My Name is Pauli Murray. I didn't know about Peggy Cooper Davis and all the work she did decades ago. Again, never learned it in law school. Nobody ever said, oh, you know, this is why bodily autonomy is protected in the 14th Amendment. This is what it was to be a slave and to be, you know, raped forcibly for economic purposes. This is what it was to split up your family, to take your children away, to have husbands and wives separated. That's why the 14th Amendment contains a right to bodily autonomy and family mm-hmm. integrity. And when you hear Republican senators be like, oh, that's not anywhere in history, that's not in the Constitution, it's because that's been erased. Because all that work has been erased. And if you listen to the debates, it's spectacularly, explicitly clear that they were trying to give freed slaves the rights to control their bodies, their reproductive systems, their families, who they married, and how they raised their children. So that's been erased. I never learned that in law school because somebody decided that wasn't material. And it is why you had, during Ketanji Brown Jackson's hearing, one senator after another talk about this as though it's this fanciful cotton candy right. So one of the things that you're saying that I think is so important is that these stories are there. They're there. We just forgot them. We forgot to tell them. We forgot to teach them. And at the risk of saying the dread words like critical race theory, the efforts now to erase more and more and more of the underpinnings of structural racism, of structural sexism and misogyny and homophobia is an effort to get to exactly what you're describing, which is a place where this all makes perfect sense because we don't remember anything else. Right. And so what I love about both writing the book and sort of doing all this deep work, listening, you know, to Dorothy Roberts, listening to Peggy Cooper Davis, unearthing the work of Pauli, is that all of this work has been done. It's right there. You can check it out on Amazon. But like, we don't tell it.
We don't. And also I need to apologize. I'm mortified. I keep saying Ketanji Jackson Brown and it's all Jackson Brown's fault.
Jackson Brown's fault.
The only reason, Jesus Christ, Justice Jackson. Also it's that Southern thing that Joyce White Vance does too. You know, anyway. And what's sort of, should be a wake up call for all of us is that it is entirely up to us to continue to tell the stories, to continue to educate ourselves and each other, because if we don't, then that leaves this vacuum. And that's just an opportunity for the right to erase all of the other things that we need to learn and teach our children. And by the way, for those of you who aren't aware, there is absolutely nothing wrong with critical race theory. It's an actually quite valuable theory to help understand all sorts of things. And I'm not going to get into it right now because it's not why we're here, but there's nothing wrong with critical race theory. And it's also not taught it's not taught to children.
It's not taught in kindergarten. No.
Yeah. Or even high school.
No.
For the most part.
Or so, even in college, unless you...
Yeah, unless you're pre-law or something.
I learned it in law school.
Yeah. Exactly. And I learned it because I read a book.
Yeah.
So read a book, guys. So, you know, that's another thing we cannot just rest on. And that's power. And you said this to me and the rest of the nerds recently, in one of those rare moments of optimism for you. But it was also the same show in which you called yourself a fucking asshole. So
I
don't know. It was one of those days. But you said, listen, we have the mechanisms to fix this. And it looks like we will, hopefully. In November. Why are you being
I'm shrugging because, you know, it's funny because like we have the votes, we have the will, we have the ability. And, you know, the idea that this is just being stymied by a bunch of dark money, a bunch of corporate self-interest. I mean, the problems here are not democracy problems. They're broken democracy problems.
And you know, stymied by an entire political party that is anti-democratic and pro-fascism. I mean, that's kind of a problem when we're dealing with all of these headwinds. But I was in reading your book, especially the part about the Women's March, and I just remember thinking, and you know, how everything's unfolded in the last 4 years and all the complications with the 2020 election and how difficult it was to deal with all of the multiple crises we were dealing with, from Black Lives Matter protests to the election, the economy, was COVID. And I'm like, you know, I often focus on the fact that 12 million more people voted for Donald in 20 than in 2016, which is fucking heartbreaking. But then I think, okay, so almost 8 million more people voted for Joe Biden, and a lot of Democrats maybe didn't vote because we care about COVID. So I, you know, that's something, maybe that's something we have in our back pocket too, that it's less of a concern. Maybe I'm just, you know, trying to make myself feel better, but you know, the Republican vote wasn't suppressed by fears of COVID.
I think it was suppressed in some sense when Donald said, don't vote by mail. Right.
But he's still going to do that.
Yep. Yeah.
So I don't know.
I mean, he was bargaining against interest there because he was telling people who were his people, stay home rather than vote by mail. And that didn't help him. But, you know, I think one of the things that has changed, and I'm one of those people who's like looking at Kansas and looking at Michigan and looking at, you know, Alaska. And I think women are fired up. And I think that something really quite seminal is happening right now. And look, it's worrisome when you see the disparity between, you know, men and women and how they're polling. I mean, I think one of the things that scares me is the optics of a Supreme Court in which you have three women who will be persistently in dissent for years to come, two of whom are women of color, right? Like, it looks terrible. It seems to be kind of a massive ratification of the structural problem we've been talking about the whole time. But if I'm right that something is going on, that people are looking around, I think one of the things that's happening is that these stories are really landing. You know, the stories, whether it's, you know, the asylum seekers who were shipped up to Martha's Vineyard, who were just had heartbreaking stories of why they were seeking to come to this country, or the women who are literally left to be septic before they can terminate a not viable pregnancy. I mean, those stories are salient. And Rebecca Traister, who I quote several places in the book, always says that what the other side is great at doing is telling stories, even if it's about a zygote. I mean, they're just so good at animating that zygote with like twinkly blue eyes and chubby cheeks. And, you know, it's a zygote. And I think that we have actual real suffering and hardship and vulnerability and inequality, and we don't tell the stories. So I think one of the things that you're describing, both with COVID and I would say with Dobbs, is an opportunity to step into this like conversation and say, like, no, actually, climate change, Puerto Rico, you know, actually, women dying, Dobbs, actually, you know, federal abortion ban, federal personhood law. And I think those are stories that people are receptive to.
Right. And the story about what we can do when we show up. And what kinds of changes we can affect, because it isn't just about getting enough senators to pass voting rights, although that's important. It's not just about having enough senators to make sure that Roe is codified into federal law, or that we save the House so that we don't have Jim Jordan reopening Benghazi investigations and impeaching Joe Biden for no reason. It's also about changing the system in ways that it can be changed, so there is more equity in this country. And that would be getting rid of the filibuster, changing, getting rid of the Electoral College and stuff like that. The power is in the story, and your narratives are just so compelling and important. And again, it's a beautifully written book, which everybody needs to go get and read now. I'm taking up a lot of your time, but I feel like I would be completely remiss if we didn't talk about a woman who is going to be one of the chapters in volume 2 of Lady Justice. That would be Tish James, Attorney General of New York. Just any quick thoughts on what is a reasonably interesting development out of New York today?
I mean, it's spectacular, and it hits all the points you made. You know, this is somebody who very carefully built a sweeping, I would say, far bigger swing than I thought, case, right? Not just against Donald Trump, not just against the company, but against the kids, against the family, and did so with, you know, again, behind the scenes toil, work, you know, a team of people working away on this. I mean, for me, this is, it's like Fani Willis, right? Mm-hmm. In Georgia, who is also doing the same, Black women both, who, yep, are doing, you know, this yeoman's work, for which, you know, history may or may not credit them, but like lets you and I credit them, because a lot of people thought that this was too ambitious, too much. Mm-hmm. He's untouchable. You know, we've seen all the themes that let him escape. I call him a greasy watermelon in a recent, you know, you just think you got your arms around the greased watermelon and he slides away. But bless them, you know, they just like will keep grabbing. I know it's, once you think of that image, it's really hard to let go of, and kind of spoils watermelon for the rest of the year.
It's okay. I don't like watermelon. Okay, so I'm good. Well, I love
you're,
it.
You're good.
I love it.
But I think this is just every single theme that I tried to pick out about, these are not trivial powers, you know? Right. The power, right, to investigate, to subpoena, to force somebody to sit down and take a deposition. These are huge powers, and they are available to any woman who wants to pick up the tools of the law and use them. And so for me, I guess I just think this reinforces this basic theme of, these women are extraordinary. They're also very ordinary. If you look around, they are everywhere. Right. And I think that instead of like buying the Tish James mug, or, you know, I think we have to think really, really carefully about what it is that she's doing and how we scale it up and, mm-hmm, how we support it, how we elect people like that in every single, yep, state. Yep. And how we vanquish the sort of feeling of nihilism that nothing can ever change because everything, as we said earlier, sucks. I just, right, think that way is the assured path to the demise of everything we are fighting for, you and I.
Exactly. And that is hopeful. That
never thought you'd hear it from this guy, did you? Little hope?
I've seen it. You know, one does not write the book you just wrote if one does not have hope. So I'm incredibly grateful that you did write it. And again, everybody needs to
hold it up just so people, yeah, can see, please, that it's bright pink.
It's bright pink.
It's bright pink.
And it's incredible.
Thank you, Mary.
Dahlia, this was so cool for me to have you all to myself. I know
you love me best, right?
Of course.
Each of my kids says to me, you love me best, right? It's okay.
And the answer is always yes.
Understood. Yes. Whoever's asking. You say that to all the nerds.
No nerd has ever asked me before. So far,
none is as troubled as this one.
But this is incredible. And the book has helped me understand things in a way that makes me feel better about some things anyway. And I wish you luck for the rest of the week. I'm sure I can't even imagine what your schedule is like, because, you know, both of my books came out during COVID, so I didn't have to do anything.
it's back. It's happening. I'm very excited for you to see them come through the door with a battering ram and a hatchet. Like, whatever is going to happen next is going to be amazing.
But I think you need to get in touch with the front desk.
I'm going to do that right now. I hope it's a fruit basket.
Please report back.
It's not a fruit basket hotel. I think I just want to say, Mary, because I really, you know, appreciate what you do. And I know both of us frequently feel like we are saying the same things over and over. I often say to my editor, like, I have written this piece 1,000 times. I cannot write this piece again. Like, if I write the walls are closing in piece and then, like, you know, learn that they're not, like, greasy watermelon, but I think that what you have sort of dedicated yourself to doing, like with this show and with the other work you're doing, which is keeping a chronicle and, you know, holding power to account and not letting people be lied to, is just, again, I think it's the work of the book, but it's also, I think, the essential work of democracy. So I really want to thank you, because I don't know if I thank you often enough. So thank you.
You thank me way too much, and I really appreciate that. But, you know, you inspire me. I have been reading your work long before I met you. And it is brilliant, and you are brilliant and inimitable. And I am grateful to everything you do. I'm particularly grateful that you're one of the Nerd Avengers, because that just makes me happy.
Best nerd ever. I won, nerds. I won. Thank
you're pretty good fucking nerd, I have to say. But seriously, Dahlia, this was incredible. And I appreciate everything you do. Thank you. Hopefully I'll see you Tuesday with the rest of the not quite so favorite nerds.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Take care.
Thanks for having me. Bye.
Bye. Well, that was incredible. I'm really happy that Dahlia was able to be here and spend so much time, because, again, her book just came out on Tuesday. So book launch week can be something of a trial, you know, especially now that people are out in the world. So again, forget about my recommendation. Hillary Clinton recommends this book. Okay. Like, she tweeted about it. So that is something that we should all take to heart. Again, it's called Lady Justice, Women, the Law, and the Battle to Save America. So thank you so much for being here. I hope that we will see you on Tuesday for our next strategy session with the Nerd Avengers. That's 12 p.m. Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific at youtube.com/Politicon. And of course, we'll have our regular Thursday night show next, at 7 p.m. Eastern, 4 p.m. Pacific, also at youtube.com/Politicon. And when you're on Politicon's YouTube page, please subscribe to Politicon's channel. It doesn't cost anything. It just helps us get our numbers higher. Like the episode and click on this bell, because that way you will be sure to get every video that drops, not just the episodes, but the shorter videos I'm doing anytime we have an emergency session, which we did yesterday, to talk about everything that's happening with Tish James and in New York. And that is it for tonight. Thank you so much for being here. I appreciate all of your great comments. And have an amazing weekend. And until next Tuesday, please stay safe and be kind.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.